You're listening to a UC San Diego podcast.
Everyone else, I'm sorry. I hope things clear up by next Monday. All right, so we didn't quite get finished what we started on Monday, so just to sort of try and pick up from where we left off, we started looking at supervised learning. And really, for the first 3 weeks, we're going to be looking at supervised and unsupervised learning. For the first 2 weeks, we're just going to be looking at supervised learning. So very, very roughly speaking, this is the process of trying to determine the underlying function that allows us to generate labels given some data. In other words, we want to try and model the data in order to predict labels and solve some particular problem. So this is in contrast to sort of unsupervised learning, which is something we'll start looking at in week 3. Here, with unsupervised learning, the goal is not necessarily to try to model some output variable directly, like we're going to do with regression and classification. But in unsupervised learning, we're really going to be trying to just more broadly model data or look for structure in data, something like that. So we're going to look at ideas like dimensionality reduction and community detection, where the basic idea is not to predict some output variable necessarily, but we're given some very, very, very high dimensional data. We want to find some small number of dimensions that can sort of best explain or best capture its properties. Or we're given some very, very, very high dimensional social network. We want to split that up into a small number of communities that essentially approximate or which capture its dimension, its adjacency structure. So that's in contrast to supervised learning, where we're really trying to solve this mapping between inputs and outputs. So I don't know, maybe that's a bit of a vague distinction at this point. The way I like to think about these two things is that with supervised learning, we're trying to estimate some function between input features and some output variables. With unsupervised learning, we're really trying to say, well, what are the good features going to be in the first place? So if I'd like to solve some predictive task, say on a social network, well, what should my features be? Am I going to use the adjacency matrix directly? It's very difficult to do. It's incredibly high dimensional. But maybe I could split up my social network into communities that approximate or which sort of model the adjacency structure. And then the various memberships to those communities could be useful as features to solve some other predictive task, like predicting political affiliation. So very roughly speaking, it'll become clearer in the next couple of weeks, but unsupervised learning is a way of finding structure in the data that we can use as features, and then supervised learning is when we're already given the features and we'd like to predict some output variable. Anyway, what we started looking at on Monday was just regression, which is like the simplest approach where we're trying to learn a mapping between input features and output variables, in this case where the output variable is a real number, essentially. So the formula we looked at was something like this. We saw the solution to this formula, which is fairly straightforward. So this is for our entire set of training data for an individual item. This looks more like xi dot theta is equal to yi. And we saw the solution to this equation. Obviously, you can't just divide this whole thing by x, because it's a rectangular matrix. You can't invert it either, so you have to do this funny process, which is called the pseudo-inverse, and that gives you the solution for theta. Okay, and the next thing we started doing is that we started looking at trying to implement this in some code. So we were trying to come up with some function that said basically, how do people's preferences towards beers vary as a function of age? So we were trying to fit some model that looked like this, looked like rating is equal to theta naught plus theta 1 times age. If you want to convert this to a matrix, you can think about this as being your output variable, which is all of the ratings, y1, y2, up to yn, is equal to just the number 1, followed by the age, age 1, age 2, all the way up to age n, times the vector theta naught, theta 1. Okay, so that's our model as like a matrix problem. That's what the model's essentially capturing. You can also just draw it as basically a simple linear function. On the x-axis, we have the person's age. On the y-axis, we have the rating. And all this model is assuming is that the rating either increases as a function of age or it decreases as a function of age. We don't know yet what this function actually looks like, but that's what we're going to run this code to find out. Okay, so where did our code go? So this is as far as we got. We just did some import statements to load in some libraries. We wrote some functions to pass the data, and we loaded it in from a file. Next thing we can actually do is look at the data. So we have all these various fields. The one we're trying to predict is just, I think, review slash taste. Okay? So we're going to say, what taste score is the person going to assign this as a function of age? Yeah? Yeah. So there's two ways to get them. One is I put the annotated version on the website, which you don't see everything I erase and redo and whatever. The other way is to just watch the podcast, where you can see the annotations in real time. Okay, so yes, all the annotations will be there. I bought one of these things because people complained that they couldn't read my handwriting on this much chalkboard. So, you know, appreciate feedback as to whether this thing actually works well. But yeah, hopefully the podcast is a reasonably high fidelity reproduction of the lecture. Anyway, we're trying to use this data to predict the taste score from the user's age. Now, I guess this user didn't specify their age. It's not compulsory to specify your age on Beer Advocate, so we can find someone who did. They didn't either. They didn't either. They didn't either. Okay, here we go. This person told us everything about themselves. They gave us their complete life history. We have their age in seconds. We have their gender. You know, obviously, age in seconds is not some field that's directly available from the website. I had to scrape that. This is the raw value. They were born on June 16th, 1901. You know, possibly that's not true. But we'd like to use this value, which I've converted to a number of seconds, to predict how their preferences are going to change. So even if this value is not a real value, it might tell us something. Maybe those people who lie about their age on websites have different beer preferences from those who tell the truth. So even this dishonest feature could still be useful to us in a predictive capacity. Anyway, so only some of the data contains the fields we want. So let's filter it to grab those users. This is going to make a copy of the data in case I screw something up. And then this line is just going to go through this copy of the data and just make a new data subset only for those users who specified their age. Okay, and now the age variable should be present for everyone. Okay, seems to have worked. Now, we can make some feature vector out of this. The feature vector is just going to be 1, which is the offset term, followed by the age in seconds feature. Okay, looks good. We'll just compute that for every single point in our data. And let's look at, say, the first 10. All right, so this is what our feature matrix looks like. The first column is going to be all 1s corresponding to the offset. The second column is going to be the age in seconds of every single user. Same thing for the output variable. I think we said we'd do taste. Okay, so that's the output we're trying to predict. Now, we can just do this through a library function. And then see what the outputs look like. We get a model which is something like this. below that I have the code that does it just using some matrix inversions, essentially does it the linear algebra way. It should give you the same thing, just to convince yourself that this library function is not actually doing that much. But anyway, what's the model we actually get? Basically, it looks like it's saying the rating is equal to 4.06 minus 1 e to the negative 10 times your age in seconds. So, I don't know, not very much. What's that number? That's very small. So, here I'll just multiply it by the number of seconds in an hour, the number of hours in a day, number of days in a year. You can skip the last one for the moment. So now it's measured in years rather than seconds. This is saying every year you get older, your rating goes down by this much. It's still pretty small, so yeah. Multiply it by 100. And that says if you live to be 100 years old, then your preference for beer is going to go down by about a third of a star. Have we learned something? I don't know. But in any case, we have a model. This is how beer preferences vary with age. You can do the same thing with ABV, but that's going to be in the homework. Essentially, what's going to happen in the homework is to show you how you can fit more complicated functions than just a linear one. So rather than fitting rating as a function of ABV, like this, ABV is alcohol by volume, by the way, if people don't know that. So rather than fitting a function like this, which is just theta naught plus theta 1 times ABV, you can fit something more complicated. So you might wonder, how can we use a linear model like this to fit what's obviously a nonlinear function? Well, it's only got to be linear in theta. So we can actually do nonlinear transformations of the features. So you can fit a model like this one plus theta 2 times ABV squared plus theta 3 times ABV cubed, and so on and so forth. So just by adding additional features, which are transformations of the original features, you can fit more complicated functions. Like you could say, I think my rating is some polynomial function of the alcohol by volume, which is maybe realistic. I mean, as things get more and more alcoholic, they don't necessarily get uniformly better, right? There comes a point. You'll find what that is. Okay, so first thing, how do we actually interpret these values? So imagine we ran this. Okay, these are not exactly the same values I obtained, but imagine this is the model that we ran for predicting the rating as a function of age. So something like 3.4 plus 10 e to the negative 7 times age in seconds. So, I mean, who can say in words what this value corresponds to? I mean, okay, it corresponds to the slope. Got it. But what does that really mean? Yeah. Okay, but how... What... Well, this one's bigger. This is 10 to the negative 7. That's huge. Compared to 10 to the negative 10. This is saying... This is big enough that something would really be going on. I mean, in general, generally speaking, what would you say is happening as the person gets older here? Can you give me, like, a sentence? By how much? I guess I'm just trying to be a bit more precise. So really what I want you to say is for every unit change in this variable, if they get 1 second older, their rating goes up by this amount. So they, every second, they rate beer 10 e to the negative 7 points higher. So really, in words, what this is saying is that a unit change in the feature, which is a second, corresponds to this much change in the rating. Okay? Similarly, can you give me an interpretation of this variable?
When you're boarding, your rating compared.
What's that?
When you was born.
Yeah, exactly. So this is basically saying, what is the rating for a newborn user? I mean, hopefully that never actually appears in the data set. But really you're like extrapolating from this value to say, if all of the features had value zero, then what would the rating be? That's the interpretation of the first value. So it's not to be confused with something like, you know, it's not the mean, it's not the average value or something. The average user certainly doesn't rate beta in the same way that we might expect a newborn baby to. But it's saying, if all the features were zero, this is how we would expect the person to rate things. So that's sort of the correct way to interpret this offset term. It's not quite an average. If there's only the offset, it will happen to be the average, but in the presence of a bunch of other features, it corresponds to something slightly different. So we'll see that with a different type of feature. So if we'd like to predict rating as a function of gender, we've got to do something a bit different. Age, it's a real valued feature. We can do it pretty straightforwardly. But if we want to have something like rating equals theta naught plus theta 1 times gender, it's not quite going to work, right? So we need some representation of the variable we'd like to use. So what's a good way to represent gender? 1 and 0. Okay, sure. So what we might like to say is that so female equals 1, male equals 0. We have this offset term as well, of course, so we're going to have males rate things according to theta naught, females rate things according to theta naught plus theta 1. So that's the kind of model we might like to try and fit. All right? So any other way you might want to represent males or females? Two separate variables? Yeah, I mean, that's like, we could say that male is equal to 0, 1, and female is equal to 1, 0, right? And then our models would look more like this. They'd say that the male rating is equal to theta naught plus, I guess, theta 2, and the female rating is equal to theta naught plus theta 1. All right? Any reason to prefer one model over the other? Or equivalent? I don't know. Like one better? I mean, they're basically equivalent, right? They have the same expressive power. They can both encode the same things. This one's maybe in slightly different interpretation. It's saying theta naught is how they're going to rate things. I mean, if we don't know their gender, I guess, and females rate thing, knowing that they're female changes their rating by this much, knowing that they're male changes their ratings by this much. In the case of the previous model, it's a little bit different. It's saying theta naught is how males rate things, and then theta 1 is the difference between male and female ratings, okay? Just as expressive, but slightly different interpretations of the parameters. There's one more issue, though, which is this model has an extra dimension, okay? This has three dimensions, an offset, a male term, a female term. This one only had two. So it doesn't seem like a real issue, but sort of wasting a dimension in our model can actually be an issue. If you think about in this case, what does our feature matrix look like? X, well, the first column is going to be all ones, like it usually is. The second column, okay, it's going to say who's female, right? So it's going to be some zeros and some ones. And the third column is going to be just the opposite of this. So, yeah, like I said, it's a bit redundant. We know we can express the same thing with just two features. Here we've used three. So really, this feature is just 1 minus this feature. It's maybe not obvious yet why it's a problem, but let's actually try and solve this system. Now, X transpose X is equal to what? It's going to be a 3x3 matrix. We multiply the first column by itself, you get 7. First column by the second column, 4. First column by the third column, 3. You get the idea. Second by the first, 4. Second by the second, 4. Second by the third, 0, because they're the opposite of each other. Third by the first, 3. Third by the second, 0. Third by the third, 3. Okay, are we seeing the problem yet? Maybe almost. So this row, say, is equal to A. This row is equal to B. This row is equal to A minus B. Are we still happy, or are we shocked? Exactly. We've got to invert this matrix. We've got to take X transpose X inverse X transpose Y. We can't do this, okay? You can't invert this matrix because it has linearly dependent rows, okay? That's bad. So, I don't know, it seems like maybe a bit of a subtle argument, but what's really happening here is if I waste a feature, if I have some feature which is just a combination of all the other features, I'm going to end up with a matrix that's not invertible. All right? There's a more obvious way to see it, I think. So, suppose my model looked like this. Rating equals 2 plus 3 times male plus 4 times female. All right? Fair enough. This would be equivalent to saying rating equals 1 plus 4 times male plus 5 times female. Okay, so all I've done is I've taken weight away from the offset term and I've added it back to the other two features. And I can do that because these features are just a combination of each other. So I can get two models which are completely equivalent, have exactly the same error. Neither of these models is better than the other one. And that's kind of intuitively what makes this system unsolvable. There's a sort of continuum of equally good solutions, and there's no way the model has of choosing between them. That problem doesn't arise if the features are all linearly independent, but it does arise in this case where I have like a redundant feature. So, you know, we'll see a smart way to get around that later, but in the meantime, don't waste any dimensions, okay? Just make your feature representation as concise as possible. So, yeah, simple example of this. How might you go about representing the month? What's a simple feature representation? What's the simplest feature representation you could have for the month? 1 to 12. Okay, sounds pretty good to me. Jan equals 1. Feb equals 2. So on and so forth. Really what that's going to give you is a predictor that looks something like this. It's going to say there's January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December. And, okay, yeah, you can go ahead and fit some linear function to that. Any problem? It's great, isn't it? It says you can like beer more as the year progresses, or you can like beer less as the year progresses. What happens at the end of the year? I don't know. You have some bender on New Year's Eve, and you just revert. And the model continues like this. So, I don't know. Maybe that's not the most realistic model. If you'd like to capture something like the notion of temporal change between months, all that a linear model like this can say is you like things more or you like things less, but when it wraps around, everything just reverts. So, maybe can we use this same idea that we tried for gender and have a categorical feature for the month instead, all right? So how would that look? What would be the representation for January? Sorry, can you repeat that? Okay, so January is going to look like this. 1 followed by 11 zeros. That's 6 zeros. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I can guess what you'll say for February. 0, 1, 0, 0, 0. Any other representation we might use? Okay, that's an option. You need four values, right? January equals February equals etc. Anything else? I mean, any refinement on the first one, perhaps? Yeah. I mean, it's kind of the same thing with gender, right? We've perhaps got a redundant feature here. If we know it's not January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, must be December, right? So if knowing the first 11 features tells us the value of the 12th feature, we don't need the 12th feature. So, I mean, okay, same thing, chop off the last value. It would work. I don't know what it would do, though. So that's going to say the last point is going to alternate every month. So it's going to, well, first of all, I'll show what this sort of 11-dimensional representation looks like. You have an offset term, and then you have a delta for every month. So December just gets the offset. February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December. And then you get some different offset for every other month. Okay, there's not 12 values there, but you get the idea. And then it's just going to look like a step function. All right, so this would be the type of linear model you could fit just by representing the month using this kind of encoding. Using this, you get something funny. So the last variable, is January to December, is going to be something that shifts every month. The second last variable is going to be something that shifts every 2 months. Third last variable is going to be something that shifts every 4 months, so on. And you're going to try and add those things up to predict. Actually, maybe that's not so silly after all. It's kind of like a binary version of a sine wave, right? So you might be able to capture the fact that there's some year-long periodicity, maybe. Potentially. This could work. I'd have to think more about whether this works, but it's a bit goofy. This is kind of simple. It's only 11 dimensions. We can afford it. Yeah? Of using this representation? I mean, it's just fewer features. I mean, the high-level intuition is that features are expensive. You want to use as few features as possible to encode your data. The reason this might work is because it's going to be able to capture very short-term oscillating trends and longer-term oscillating trends and something like that. It's a funny way to represent things, but yeah. Well, I mean, both models are essentially assuming some shape of this curve, right? So the... Well, what I mean, I guess you have to use your intuition, for one, as to what's realistic. Is this a realistic shape? It's not very flexible. It's only one parameter. It can do two things. It's going to be a sawtooth shape that either goes straight up or that goes straight down and then repeats on the 31st of December, which is some magical date, according to the model, for some reason. So that somehow it's not quite realistic. This is more realistic, or at least it's more flexible, which is to say your taste varies as a function of the month. So, yeah. I mean, we'll get to that. So each of these models, you're going to solve this this least squares problem. You're going to take X transpose X inverse X transpose Y, and then you're going to see how accurate was my model. I mean, I guess we can do that. I computed this model based on the age. Like the other output for this, I forget what the model was, but the other output for this function is the residuals. This term here is the sum of squared errors. So it's saying how wrong was the model? How different were the predicted values of the model from the true values? That's all we care about, right? So the only difference between these models once you fit them is they're going to approximate the output variable better or worse. And obviously a more realistic function or a more flexible function is going to be better at predicting the output variables than an unrealistic one or an inflexible model. This is what you actually get if you fit that data. So this is just months of the year. How does the rating change as a function of the month? Again, it's not much, but now maybe that you look at it, these are just, it's just a simple step function, but it kind of almost looks smooth. So there seems to be some year-long periodicity. People get really unhappy around mid-year, they're, at least in terms of their beer preferences, or maybe they're just drinking terrible beer in the middle of the year, and things sort of start to pick up again around, I don't know, Thanksgiving, something like that. So at least the fact that the model fits some smooth curve maybe is a hint that our model is realistic looking. That's a bit hand wavy, but of course you can just measure does it predict the output variable or not. So yeah, certainly this could be due to seasonal beers. I mean, Christmas beer is terrible though, and people seem to like that. I don't know. Okay, so final example is just to say what's going to happen if we add more and more random features to the model. So we just try and build a predictor out of complete nonsense. So rather than using the age in seconds or the months, let's just use an offset term plus random times for I in range 5. So an offset term plus 5 random features. Okay, so what do our features look like? They look like this, they're complete nonsense. Okay, let's get rid of a few of those. We're still predicting the same output variable. Let's fit our model, and let's see what our errors look like. Actually, it's about the same as using the ABV, right? We use 5 random features. We got about as good a model as if we used the alcohol by volume. What happens if we have, 10 random features? This gets even sillier looking, I guess. Fit the model, look at the residuals. They've probably gone down, have they? Or is that a higher number? I mean, they are random, so sometimes it won't go down. 50? How many do I need to make a point? Let's not even look. Okay, it's gone down a little bit. Not by much, but on average, this is going to monotonically decrease. If you throw in thousands and thousands of random features, eventually, your error is going to go down to 0. So your model is going to look like it's predicting the output variable perfectly. Really all that's happening is sometimes random features happen randomly to be correlated with the data. And that's kind of what the main point of today's class is, I mean, getting back to your question, is really how do you determine that your model is good or bad? So how do you diagnose a model based on linear regression? Okay, so all this time we've been trying to minimize this function, the mean squared error. We've been saying to the objective, the measure of how good our model is looks like this. We take all the predictions, we subtract the true value, we square that, we add it up, we divide by the number of values, okay? So, why do we use this? Why don't we use something like 1 on n sum of absolute value of yi minus xi dot theta? Why do this rather than this? Everyone's done this forever since we were but wee babes. why not use the absolute value instead? Any good reason? What's that? I mean, this would be zero in the same circumstances. This one would be zero. Yeah, this is an absolute value, right? I mean, all the. I mean, sure. This is a smooth function. This is a pointy function. That's really the only difference. This is saying if the difference is very large, I'm going to penalize it according to a square, which is bigger. But so I'm penalizing big errors more with this model. Why? You know, is there a good motivation for that? Okay, some people are saying Gaussian noise. So, if you want to choose which error measure to optimize, you might want to have some noise model. So, yeah, a reasonable noise model says that my outputs, yi, maybe are equal to my prediction, xi dot theta, plus some noise. And a good noise model would be Gaussian noise, I suppose. Or if you want to write this differently, yi minus xi dot theta is distributed according to a Gaussian. Okay, so I have some Gaussian noise model. What would that look like? Can I remember my formula for a Gaussian? 1 on sigma root 2 pi e to the negative yi minus xi dot theta squared divided by 2 sigma squared. Okay, that's kind of saying, what is the probability that I would observe an error this large under a Gaussian noise model? So if my noise is zero mean with sigma standard deviation, the probability of observing this error is equal to this huge expression here. I can then do this for a whole set of predictions just by taking the product over all I. I don't know why that happens sometimes. Okay, so this is now what's called the likelihood. So this is saying, For my vector of predictions, xi dot theta, what is the likelihood that I would observe that whole vector of predictions with true values yi, assuming the noise is Gaussian? So I'd like to maximize that likelihood. I'd like to choose the parameters, or I'd like to choose the model, such that the probability of observing these errors that I observed is as high as possible. So we can write that out, and you'll see what's going on if you haven't already. So I want to maximize this expression. I can just take its log, sum of I negative yi minus xi dot theta squared on 2 sigma squared minus log sigma root 2 pi. Okay, I'm trying to maximize it, so I don't care about with respect to theta, so I don't care about some constant, and I don't care about some constant multiplier either. So really I'm trying to maximize this expression, which is going to be equivalent to minimizing this expression. So maximizing the likelihood is equivalent to minimizing the mean squared error. So that's where this whole idea of minimizing a mean squared error as opposed to a mean absolute error or something like that comes from. We're implicitly assuming that noise is Gaussian distributed, and then we're saying I want to maximize the likelihood under this Gaussian noise assumption, which corresponds to minimizing the mean squared error. Okay? That's the assumption we're implicitly making. The second question, I suppose, is whether that assumption is a good one or not. So can we actually measure, given some model, does the errors it's producing badly violate this Gaussian noise assumption? So there's a pretty simple diagnostic you can use to do this. It's essentially a plot. You can just write down, and I'll show you how to generate. You can write down all of your errors. I don't know. I'll make up some numbers. 5.5, negative 0.5, 3, 1, negative 2, 4, that we've got it right once, something like that. Now, suppose I observe these errors for my 7 data points. I can sort them, and otherwise I can look at their order statistics. What do we have? Negative 2, negative 0.5, 0, 1, 3, 4, and 5.5. Okay, so this is the errors I observed, ordered by their size. And I can say, how does this compare to the idealized notion of what errors I would have observed if my error really were Gaussian distributed? So we can basically compare this vector of values to what you would obtain under an idealized Gaussian distribution. Now, I can't remember what an idealized Gaussian distribution looks like off the top of my head, but you can imagine reading some numbers off a table. They're going to be symmetric. They're going to get bigger as you go further out. For instance, okay? So whatever these values really are, you can just read them off a normal probability table. You can compare them to the order statistics you observed in your actual data. We can say, how does this plot, or how does this value compare against this value? So you can imagine you have this curve, which is sort of on the x-axis, the idealized Gaussian. And on the y-axis, it's the observations. And what you'd really like to see is that when you do a scatter plot of these values against each other, it basically follows a straight line. All right? It says there's just an equivalence between the idealized Gaussian errors and the errors you observed. Of course, a few things could go wrong. So you can imagine the four basic cases you could have. You've got here's your Gaussian distribution. And how does your data deviate from a Gaussian distribution? Let me just plot some things I'm going to need. And I'll change my pen color. So one way is that it could be a more peaked distribution, right? So I guess it should be higher than the Gaussian distribution in the, dang it. Like this, right? What this would say when I try to plot these two distributions against each other is that this value in the Gaussian corresponds to a smaller value in the observed data. So then when you try and do the scatter plot, it's going to look kind of like that, I think. The other case could be that it's a very long-tailed distribution, in which case the corresponding plot is going to look like this. Otherwise, it could be, you know, some combination of the two. It could be short on one side and long on the other, or it could be long on one side and sort of short on the other. Okay, maybe not the best drawings in the world, but you get the idea. Exactly. So, I mean, these are just going to be combinations of each other. So, this one here, which is short-tailed on the left and heavy-tailed on the right, is going to look the same as this plot on the left and this plot on the right. So, it's going to go like that, and the third one's going to be the opposite. All right. Anyway. Don't worry yourselves too much with exactly what kind of distributions generate these things. What you're really looking for is to say, does my data follow a straight line, yes or no? If it doesn't, then probably your normality assumption is unjustified in some weird and complicated way. This is what we get when we do it for my ABV predictor. So this is theta naught plus theta 1 times ABV. This is the errors generated by that model compared to idealized normal errors. It's not following a straight line, is it? I mean, it looks like this one. So somehow the error distribution looks something like this. So we very rarely see large negative errors. We very commonly see large positive errors. Any hypothesis? I mean, I don't know. It's a bit of a funny predictor, isn't it? Like, ABV is always positive. The rating's always positive. So if this coefficient was positive, then we could sometimes think, oh, that one outlying beer that has 70% alcohol is going to be rated 25 stars. That would induce a very large positive error. But we can never have ABV less than zero, so we can never observe a very large negative error. Okay, and that's sort of a hand-wavy argument for why maybe this doesn't conform to the normality assumptions. I don't know. Moral of the story is just keep on going using the MSE like you always have been. If this happens, I don't know what you're going to do about it, other than try and fit a better model. But it's at least good to know where this motivation for the mean squared error comes from and to be able to actually check if maybe things are not quite conforming to it as well as they should be. All right? Moving on, the next question we might want to answer is, what's actually a good MSE? So if I'm trying to predict beer ratings and my MSE was 3, should I be happy? Certainly, if my MSE was 1, I'd be happier. But would I be happy enough yet? I don't know. So the answer is kind of that the MSE is somehow proportional to the variance. So I think we can make this a little bit more obvious. We can write down the formula for the mean of the output variable. Now, the formula for the variance is just going to be equal to how much does the output variable deviate from the mean on average. So y bar minus yi squared. And the formula for the MSE kind of looks very similar to this, right? Xi dot theta minus yi squared. So, yeah, comparing these two functions, the variance is exactly what you get when you plug in the mean to the MSE formula, right? So if you had a very, 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 very simple predictor that just predicts the mean all the time, your MSE is going to be equal to your variance, okay? So if I'm trying to come up with some movie recommender and it says, how much do you like Pitch Black? The dumbest thing I could do is just, I could forget about you, I could forget about Pitch Black, just go through my whole movie database, add up all the ratings, divide by n, and say, you're going to rate it 3.8 stars. No personalization, no anything like that. Simplest model you could do. In that case, the MSE is going to be equal to the variance. So basically, if you have any sensible model, your MSE should be better than that. The variance is kind of an upper bound for how badly you can do by predicting the most naively, just guessing the average all the time. So to measure whether a predictor is good or not, what we might do is say, well, how does my MSE compare to the variance? Okay? If the variance is equal to the MSE of the dumbest predictor, then when I take this ratio, which is called the fraction of unexplained variance, then if we just predict the mean all the time, this value is equal to 1. That's a trivial predictor. If our MSE was 0, we have a perfect predictor. So this is now essentially going to be a number between 0 and 1 saying, at 0, we have a perfect predictor. At 1, we have the dumbest predictor. So we're just normalizing our value by the variance in the data. And that gives us now a variance-independent measure of whether our predictor is good or not. So can you suggest a predictor that has a fraction of variance unexplained of greater than 1? Is it possible? I mean, I kind of said that the dumbest thing we can do is predict the mean all the time. Can we be dumber than that? Yeah? Yeah. Predict anything other than the mean all the time. Yeah, I said predicting the mean is the dumbest. The real dumbest thing is to predict some constant value other than the mean. So that would mean the MSE is actually larger than the variance, and your fraction of unexplained variance would be greater than 1. You know, it could happen to you if you really badly overfit on some data, as we'll see later. But generally speaking, this should be a number between 0 and 1. What people actually tend to report in papers is 1 minus this quantity, which is the R squared statistic. So then it's zero for a trivial predictor, one for a perfect predictor, and sort of a negative value for a really, really silly predictor. Yeah. I mean, people do report things like the sum of absolute errors, which is not so susceptible to outliers. I don't really know, actually. I guess you'd have to have some noise model that allowed for the occasional outlier in the probability expression. I mean, the reason I don't know this is because I mainly work with rating data, for which there are no nasty outliers. It's bounded between 1 and 5. So forgive my ignorance on that question, but yeah, I mean, to really account for these weird outliers properly, you would need a noise model that allows for outliers, which simple Gaussian noise model doesn't. Something like a sum of absolute errors kind of does, but on the other hand, that's a very funny noise model too. Okay, so we saw before when we were looking at random features that we can always get a mean squared error of zero or a fraction of variance unexplained number of zero, R squared of one, just by throwing in enough random features in our model. It's eventually going to work. So what's the problem with this? Well, really we should be evaluating these things on different data than what was used to train the model. So anyone who's taken any other machine learning class will have seen this idea, but basically something that works well on training data but doesn't generalize is a model that's overfitting. So you can think about some data that I might want to fit that looks like this. I could fit it using some ridiculously high dimensional polynomial function that happens to pass through every data point exactly, or I could fit it using something like a straight line. Okay? So maybe the straight line is preferable. Can you sort of say why the straight line is preferable? Yeah, I mean, it will probably generalize to new data. We would expect that if we saw more data, then it's going to roughly lie along a line and then a very super high degree polynomial. But, I mean, why is that? I mean, what's wrong with the polynomial? It looks pretty good to me. Well, that's an assumption, right? I mean, why would you not think that a super high degree polynomial... I mean, it's a very complicated model. I guess that's, yeah. I mean, what you're getting is essentially this idea of an argument against complexity. So we have some prior knowledge that kind of tells us that complex, super, 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 super complex models are a bit silly, probably not realistic. But a simple model maybe is, which does almost as well, is maybe more sensible. So this is captured by this idea called Occam's razor. So if you hang around like atheist discussion forums or something, this is often used as an argument to try and refute the existence of God. I don't think that's what this guy had in mind. But anyway, basically this is some philosophical argument that he was making, that if you have multiple competing hypotheses that explain your universe equally well, then amongst all of those, you should choose the simplest one. A simple hypothesis is more likely to be true. So you can see how this argument we used in a philosophical sense. How does it apply to machine learning? Well, some value of our model parameters is a hypothesis about how our data should accurately be modeled. So if we have some huge set of some very high dimensional vector of totally random parameters, then perhaps we can come up with some very high-dimensional vector theta, which happens to model the data well, but under what conditions should we think that theta is very likely or unlikely? So maybe we get some vector theta that looks like this, which happens to model our data very well. Would you say that model is a simple model or a complex model? Looks reasonable? Okay, I mean, Is it more simple or more complex than this model? Maybe more complex. Is it? What makes it more complex? Can you sort of quantify that? Uses more features, okay? So this model would depend on only one feature. This model depends on 20 features. Okay, so what about something like this? Is this model more complex or more simple than this one? This one's simpler, maybe. Okay, it uses the same number of features as this one does. So in what sense is this simpler? Less variation in the features? Yeah. Okay, I don't know. What about this model? It has a lot of variation in the features, actually. But it has only one parameter. So I don't know. There's maybe not just one definition of complexity that captures all cases, but there's maybe two decent ones that you can come up with. One is that the feature shouldn't have too much variation. Or the parameter, sorry, shouldn't have too much variation. If you don't know anything, probably all of your parameters should be about equally predictive. None of them should really stick out. The other hypothesis is that the number of parameters that you use versus the number you discard is a measure of complexity. So we can kind of, these are the two ideas you have. One is that a simple model is one that has very few non-zero parameters. The other one is a simple model is one that's almost uniform. So we can kind of write down equations that express these two concepts. I'll give a bit of a proof in a minute. So if we want to get a model that has few non-zero parameters, so one that kind of looks more like this, we would like this value to be small. If we want one where the parameters are almost uniform, we'd like this value to be small. So if you don't remember this equation, then this is just a norm, which is equal to the kth root of all the parameters to the power k. All right? So, you know, don't worry about it in general. You're only ever going to see k is equal to 1 and 2 in this class, which corresponds to the sum of absolute values, and this, which corresponds to the square root of the sum of squares. So regular Euclidean magnitude, if you like. Or, you know, you could just square this and get rid of the square root sign there. Make life easier. Okay, so we're saying if we want a model that's kind of using few parameters, we'll try and minimize the sum of magnitudes of the parameters. If we want a model that has almost flat parameters, we'll try and minimize the sum of squared values of the parameters. So I'll give kind of a proof of why this happens. You can imagine a simple model that says, I'm going to predict the person's height. So height is approximately equal to, theta naught plus theta 1 times weight plus theta 2 times shoe size. All right? This is a not totally unreasonable model. Variables like weight and shoe size are going to be correlated with height. Yeah? So I would say shoe size is maybe a little bit better correlated with height than weight is. There are other ways to be heavy besides being tall. It helps to be tall, but you know, you can get a large value of weight otherwise. But so maybe this is a bit of a funny thing to do, whereas this is going to be a tighter correlation. So we have two, and these features are also very correlated with each other. So we have kind of two very similar features that we're using to build some model. Maybe one of those features is slightly better than the other one. So two models we could potentially have. One would just pick, say, we'll just pick shoe size because it's the better feature. And the other model, let's say, we'll give them both roughly equal weight, maybe a little bit more to shoe size. Then we have theta 1, theta 2, and theta prime 1, theta prime 2. Okay? Now, how should I choose which of these models to use? They both have the same L1 norm. Okay? So is equal to the L1 norm of theta prime. So if they both have the L1 norm, then in terms of their complexity under that first definition, these models look about as good as each other. But this one's going to predict a little bit better. So what I'm going to be tempted to do is just completely squash out that weight parameter, which predicts slightly worse, and I'm going to say I'm only going to use this parameter because it's a slightly better one. And that's kind of going to be why, intuitively, that this model, based on the idea of the L1 norm, is going to just, given two very similar parameters, it's just going to squash whichever one's slightly worse and pick some sparse subset of them. On the other hand, this model has a much larger L2 norm than the second one. Okay, so if you're adding up if you're summing up the squared values, what you want is for those values to have you want them to be about the same as each other. For a fixed sum of absolute values, the one with the smallest sum of squared values is going to be the one where all the variables are equal. This is going to have a very, very large, it's going to have a very, very large L2 norm. So if I'm penalizing according to this definition, I'm going to say, well, the models predict about equally well, but this model is much, much cheaper in terms of my definition of complexity. So if I'm using L1 norm, I'm going to pick this guy. And if I'm using L2 norm, I'm going to pick this one. Okay, so that's sort of your hand-wavy argument for why penalizing according to some of absolute values is going to favor picking a few good parameters, whereas penalizing according to the sum of squared parameters is going to give you roughly a uniform distribution. Okay, so regularization then is this process by which we don't just minimize our mean squared error, but we also penalize the model complexity. All right, so we have this term for how well it fits the data, but also this term for how complex the model is using either definition, and then we just trade off those two with some parameter lambda, which says how much do we care about having a good fit versus how much do we care about having a complex model. All right, so this becomes a little bit tougher to optimize. We can't just do some funny little matrix inversion here to get the optimal solution, so we need to resort to some kind of more complicated algorithm. I'll go a bit quickly because I'm running out of time a bit. So we'll just try and solve this equation for theta by something like gradient descent. So without knowing the curriculum here too well, what class does gradient descent normally show up in, if anything? 250B? 250A as well, everywhere. So many people, I guess, are familiar with gradient descent, but essentially we have some curve. We have some estimate of the curve, and to try and find the lowest point of that curve, so in other words, the smallest value of this function, a model that fits the data well but is also not very complex, what we'd like to do is just take our current estimate and move down this curve in the direction of our gradient until we get to the bottom. In other words, we're trying to just solve for the gradient to be equal to zero. Yeah? Yeah, exactly. So later on, we'll see some kind of functions that have many, many, many local minima for which this is a super nasty thing to do. Here, I'm pretty sure it should be fine. It looks to me like a convex function in theta. So the local minimum should be the minimum. We can check that if we like, but maybe not today. I'm confident that the local minimum is going to be the minimum. Okay, so all we need now is just to compute the derivative of this function, and we can use some gradient descent algorithm to find the minimum value. So f is really equal to the sum over I of xi dot theta minus yi squared plus lambda times the sum over k of theta k squared. All right, so we can compute the derivative of this with respect to theta k. Df on d theta k is equal to 1 on n. Hopefully you kind of remember some of your calculus. So we'll compute the derivative of this expression, which is just XIK, and then we pull the 2 in the front. You mean, you know, Wolfram alpha, if you don't remember. Works pretty well. Dot theta, and we reduce the power by 1, plus lambda times 2 theta k. All right? Looks correct? I think so. We're all happy. And, you know, I've given you an implementation of this in code in case you're not so comfortable with that. Here's an implementation. I think my features are a bunch of random numbers, aren't they? Let's fix that. 1, comma, datum. Let's use the ABV again. Is that better? Yes. Okay. So you can either go ahead and implement gradient descent yourself, or you can just use a library function, which I think is the more convenient way to do it. And that'll iteratively perform that operation until it converges to a local minimum. If you run this, you can watch it walk through its iterations. It has the current objective, which is the sum of errors plus the model complexity, computes the derivative, and this value keeps hopefully going down until the gradient reaches approximately zero, at which point you've arrived at a local minimum, which hopefully is the global minimum, and there's your values for theta. Okay? What's left? Yeah, last thing, which I'll just cover quickly over 5 minutes, is how do you select this value lambda? So the ways we know how to do this so far is you could say, well, I'll evaluate my optimum value of lambda on the training set. It's not going to work, right? The optimum value of lambda on the training set is don't penalize model complexity at all. All I want to do is fit the data as accurately as possible, so I'm going to choose lambda equal to zero. The other option is do it on the test set. You can't. That's cheating. I'm not going to give you the test set for the assignment anyway, so it's not going to work. So really, you need this third sample of the training data, which is not used for training or for testing, which is just called a validation set. So really, we'll split our data in three. The training set is used to optimize the model's parameters. The test set is only ever used once, the day you submit the paper. You know, you evaluate your performance on the test set, and that's just saying how well the model performs in unseen data. The validation set really is used to choose between different model types, if you like. So it's also used to fit these hyperparameters. So if every value of lambda is a different trade-off between accuracy and complexity, then every value of lambda gives us a different model. So to select between all of those models, we have to use this third set, which says, how well do I expect my model to work if I were to show it to some unseen data? So, yeah, there are a few theorems about this, which I think are maybe better explained with a picture rather than in words. Basically speaking, you can imagine what's going to happen when you train multiple models for different values of lambda. So we have lambda on the x-axis. So here, as lambda increases, we're penalizing complexity. And as lambda decreases, we're not. And on the y-axis, on the y-axis, we'll report just the error of our model. And like I said before, the dumbest thing we can do is just predict the mean all the time. So if we do things properly, then as lambda increases, a model is going to revert to a naive model, which just predicts the mean. And as lambda decreases, we're not going to penalize complexity at all, so we're just going to overfit as much as the model is capable of overfitting. Which, if you have a small number of parameters, isn't too bad, but if you have lots and lots of parameters, could be disastrous. But ultimately, you'll get some curve that's shaped like this, where your performance is asymptoting to that of a naive predictor. So that's in your training set. Your test set should look more curvy. Should look something like this. So It's always going to be higher than the performance on the training set in general if you've done things properly. So really what that means is if they're two independent samples of the same data set, which in the homework exercise maybe they're not, I forget, then your testing error should be at least as high as the training error. Your model cannot be expected to do better on unseen data than it does on the training data, yeah? Sure. So basically the two sides of this curve, on the right, this is you're penalizing complexity loads and loads and loads. So you're really going to favor just having a model that looks like choose the average all the time. This is called underfitting, right? And that's saying, I really don't want complex models, so I'm going to end up with a model that just predicts basically the mean all the time. Okay, it generalizes well to new data. In other words, there's not much separation here between my training and testing error, but it's a useless model. It's far too simple, in other words, so it can't do much. On the other side, we have overfitting. This is I have a model that's way too complex, so it's just going to behave, randomly when I apply it to new data. Certainly this could be it could be even worse if I overfit really badly than an IE predictor that just predicts the average all the time. And in the middle, we have, I guess, the sweet spot. Of course, you should always do this for the validation set too. Really, the sweet spot is wherever the sweet spot is for the validation set. So min validation set. So, one last thing. I always get at least one question at some point in the quarter, which is, okay, this is what the curves should look like, but how do you actually choose the value for these things? Well, the basic rule is this sweet spot ought to exist. Okay, so if you choose some values for lambda and your curve just looks like the right side of this plot, your values for lambda are too big. If the curve just looks like the left side of the plot, your values for lambda is too small. So what I always do in practice is start with 1, go by powers of 10 either side, etc., etc., and keep doing this, keep going further out until your curve has this shape, which hopefully it does. And that means that you've found that sweet spot between overfitting and underfitting. I think that about does it for today. We're not going to have time for the case study right now, but there's the whole quarter remaining. This is this example of regression as applied to Reddit. Last thing is the homework is online. It's maybe a little bit harder than the last homework I did for this class, or at least there's more of it. So make sure you take a look to estimate how long it's going to take you. Half of it's going to be on this week and half of it's going to be on next.
This has been a UC San Diego podcast. For more, visit podcast.ucsd.edu.